Hello, everybody. My name is Martin Grant, and I am still the Dean of Science at McGill University. Thank you. Welcome to the third lecture of Mini-Science 2009, To Infinity and Beyond. Last week, Matt Dobbs took us pretty much to infinity and beyond, actually, as he gave a lecture on astronomy's window on the birth of the universe. If you weren't there or you'd like a little recap, here's some of the things that Matt talked about. How research into cosmic microwave background, the light left over from the Big Bang, can help us learn about the origin of the universe and how it's expanding. About Matt's work on the South Pole Telescope and the challenges involved in astrophysics research, and how the universe is expanding and exhilarating. Again, as it says here, but I think it's actually expanding, but it's almost a flat universe. At the website for the mini-series, there are answers to some of the questions that I didn't get to last week when I was flipping through them. And they're interesting questions. Can we infer where we are in the universe by knowing how far back we can see in different directions? What are some of the challenges of operating a telescope at the South Pole? If it's really cold, I guess it would probably be one. Can you determine where the beginning and the end of the universe are? Okay, so those are all on the website. And now we have, since it's a faculty science event, we have skill testing questions based on last week's lecture, where there will be no wagering, please, and no gambling, and there are no points and no score. So anyway. So I'll ask these three questions that Matt provided. So the first one, I think, is pretty clear. Why is the South Pole Telescope located at the geographic South Pole? Because it's dry, yeah. It's very dry up there. It's almost like a desert, so there's no refraction of the microwave in the background. This one I found, well, anyway, I'll ask the question. You guys can answer it. I have the answers here. What is the smoking gun evidence that cosmologists are looking for that would support inflationary theories of the universe? Yes? That the whole universe is at the same temperature, well, the fluctuations around that temperature. If my hearing were not shot, I think I would definitely say that that was the correct answer. It's exactly that. It's the background polarization of the microwave background, which is supposed to be a smoking gun for inflation. And finally, Matt's last question, which Tracy gave a great answer to a second ago, and depending on my frame of mind, I'll tell you Tracy's answer. I don't know. Maybe not. Okay. What is enabling the precision cosmology measurements that scientists are making today? Yes. Oh, you're just saying that's a good place for a seat. Are you raising your hand? Sorry. It's basically all the stuff that Matt has, basically, is the answer, all his enabling thing, the technological advances of doing quantum squid measurements and the increases in computing power. And with that, at the end of this lecture, just to remind you of the rules, we'll ask you if you write down questions, and then people will pick them up and give them to me, and I'll ask the questions. If we can't answer them all, we'll put some of the questions on the website and Tracy will give answers to them. Please don't ask any questions you wouldn't want us to answer in front of your mom and dad or post on the internet. Please turn off your cell phones. Please complete the evaluation form. Oh, the mini-science lectures are all posted as webcasts on the mini-science website if you missed one, because last week was Passover, for example. And lectures will also appear on Canal Savoie in the fall. Okay, today's lecture is Tracy Webb. Tracy is an assistant professor in the Department of Physics whose research centers on the growth of structure in the universe and galaxies in particular. Since 2005, she has been a Venny Fellow at the Leiden Observatory, the Leiden University in the Netherlands. From 2002 to 2005, she was a NOVA Fellow, also at the Leiden Observatory. Leiden astronomers have included J.H. Oort, who discovered the rotation of our galaxy in the Oort cloud, of course. In 2003, Professor Webb was the recipient of the Plaskett Medal, an award given by the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the Canadian Astronomical Society for the most outstanding doctoral thesis in astronomy or astrophysics. She received her BSc in Physics and Astronomy from the University of Toronto, a master's in the same area from McMaster, and a PhD in Astronomy and Astrophysics from the University of Toronto. You can read more about Tracy Webb and a research on the biography in Close Your Packages. And with that, I give you Tracy.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here and to tell you guys about what I do every day and sometimes all night as well. I am going to be talking about Ioing universes tonight, the nature and origin of what we call now galaxies, but they have historically gone by the term Ioing universes, hence the title. I'm starting the talk with this absolutely beautiful image that I will return to a couple of times during the lecture. I know some of you have already leafed through the notes, so you probably know the answer to this question, but does anyone know what object this is? Yeah? That's M31, otherwise known as the Andromeda Galaxy. And this is, in fact, our nearest large neighbor. And it's very much a twin to our own galaxy. And I'm showing you this image because it is sort of the typical galactic image, and also because it's very much like our own Milky Way galaxy, but primarily because it's an absolutely beautiful picture. And I will be showing you many of these this evening, many taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. And it's talks like this. One of the reasons that it's such a pleasure to be here tonight is that, if you can believe it, one can actually get used to looking at pictures like this. And you forget how beautiful they are. And so lectures like this remind me that this really is spectacular, and I'm really lucky to be able to do this every day. So, without further ado, I'm going to launch right into the lecture. So I'm talking about galaxies, and I think my lecture fits nicely after the lectures of Professor Dobbs and Caspi. So Vicky Caspi was, of course, telling you about pulsars and neutron stars, which I would consider some of the smallest objects in astrophysics. These are small distance scales. She also works on extremely rapid timescales, of course. She was talking probably about millisecond pulsars that rotate many, many times per second. Matt Dobbs was talking about the opposite in both distance and timescales. He was talking about, by definition, the largest distance scales in the universe. You can't get any bigger than the universe. And also the longest time scales as well. And I'm going to be talking about something in between. Galaxies are, of course, smaller than the universe, but much larger than a pulsar. And the time scales we're talking about are, as you'll see, sort of millions and billions of years. So still quite long, but shorter compared to the age of the universe. And certainly we can see changes in galaxies over these timescales. So I've divided the talk up into essentially three sections that I'm not necessarily going to spend equal amounts of time on. We'll see how it goes. I want to start with a historical context. I want to go back to the beginning of really galactic astrophysics and talk about the discovery of galaxies, in part because I myself am interested in the history of science, and I think it's also always important when you're doing science and learning about science to remind yourself what has gone before, mistakes that people have made, and just to see how the scientific method plays out. So I'll talk a little bit about the discovery of galaxies. Then I'll jump right into what is a galaxy? How do we define a galaxy? What's it made out of? What does it look like? Really the nature of galaxies, the different types, and their defining characteristics. And then finally, the last part of the talk, which hopefully won't be too rushed, is what I actually do for a living, which is studying the origin or the formation and evolution of galaxies throughout the history of the universe. I'm going to really just highlight some of the observational evidence, current observational evidence out there for what we think is going on, and some of the basics of the models in the series that people have put together. And this part should play in a little bit with what Matt was talking about last week, because of course he was talking about the origin of the universe, which lays the groundwork for the formation of structure and galaxies afterwards. I should warn you, I have a lot of slides. I don't expect to get through all of them. A lot of them I have included in anticipation perhaps of some questions afterwards, and just to sort of gauge, you know, if you're more interested in certain topics, then I can zero in on those. But I may kind of skip a couple of slides depending on how the time goes. So let's launch back to Washington in 1920. And this is really, I think, where, you know, you can place a historical marker on the beginning of galactic science. This is the year, and I believe it happened in March of 1920. This was really a historic moment in astrophysics known as the Curtis-Shapley debate. And this debate was a real debate in a real place where Shapley and Curtis, two astrophysicists or astronomers, were debating what we call, or what at the time was known as the scale of the universe. So this was during a meeting of the National Academy of Sciences, and as many conferences often have, they wanted to have some sort of evening activity for all of the scientists that were attending the meeting. And so they thought, you know, sometimes this can be in the form of a keynote lecture. And what they wanted to do was have a debate on some really exciting, interesting, and topical, perhaps controversial topic at that time. And so they were floating around a whole bunch of different ideas, the people who were organizing the meeting. And I just pulled out a couple of interesting quotes from C.G. Abbott, who was the Home Secretary of the Academy at that time, in a letter or a few correspondences with George Ellery Hale, who was the current and, I believe, first director of Mount Wilson Observatory. So they were trying to decide what topic to focus this debate on. And I think it's really interesting. So this is one of the most famous debates, as I said, in astronomy history. There's been a lot written on it. And it's just sort of interesting to see what the state of the field was at that time and the way people saw these so-called island universes that I'm going to start talking about, because they figured very importantly into this debate on the scale of the universe. So Abbott says to Hale, and I'll just read it for those of you who can't see at the back, "I have a sort of fear, however, that the people care so little about island universes, notwithstanding their vast extent, that unless the speakers took great pains to make the subject very engaging, the thing would fall flat." So they're, at this point, debating two different possible topics for this evening debate. One is the scale of the universe and the nature of the island universes. And the other, in fact, is relativity. Those were sort of the two shortlists. And he's basically saying island universes are so boring, they're so useless, why would anyone care about them whatsoever? And of course, within a few years, these island universes were responsible for the discovery that the universe was expanding. And we've learned, I mean, that's how we found dark matter, dark energy, all these amazing things that we know about our universe now have come from these boring little island universes. And I'll skip this second quote, which I think is also amusing, and is one of the reasons why they decided not to go with relativity. You all can see it on your handout. But I just want to take a moment and explain the nature of the debate. So it was the scale of the universe and the nature of these spiral nebulae, as they were called. And sometimes they were also called island universes. So I've shown this really beautiful picture here, which was taken down in Argentina. And it's just an image of the sky, no telescope, as far as I know, which actually shows the different objects that were the focus of these debates, or this debate. And the first is this long, sorry, I'm having a little bit of trouble using my mouse here. This long cloud that you see here moving up across the image. This is, of course, something that many of you have probably seen with your own eyes in, well, probably not downtown Montreal, but in a dark location in the country. This is, of course, the disk of our own Milky Way galaxy. As I'll show you, the Milky Way is, in fact, a disk. And we live in the outer regions, and when we look inwards, this is essentially what we see on our sky, the plane of our galaxy. You can also see in this image these two little wispy blobs here. This is a southern hemisphere image, and these are the large and small Magellanic clouds, which you can see with a naked eye, and some of you may have in fact seen with your eyes if you've been from down to South America. In 1920, people knew about the Milky Way. They knew we lived in a collection of stars, and they'd mapped out a lot of the locations of these stars and had measured distances to them. So they had some idea of the scale of the universe around us. What they didn't know about were other galaxies. They could see these tiny little smudges in the sky, which looked like little gas clouds, and they called these spiral nebulae because they were nebulous, and because many of them showed sort of spirally-like pinwheel structure. They didn't know what they were. And this was really the extent of the universe in 1920. And so the subject of the debate was really, how big is the Milky Way itself? Which they thought was the entire universe, or many of them thought was the entire universe, and what was the nature of these spiral nebulae. And they're linked together in the following way. So these are the two different sides that Curtis and Shapley took. These two men did indeed believe in these two sides that they were debating. So Curtis took the view that these spiral nebulae, or the so-called island universes, as some people called them, were in fact galaxies like our very own, just like the Milky Way galaxy. They were collections of stars, they were absolutely huge, and they looked very small because they were so far away. In his view, then, the Milky Way, our own galaxy, was actually fairly small, and it did not consist of the entire universe. Or did not comprise the entire universe. So when I say small, I mean he was talking something like 30,000 light years across. Shapley, on the other hand, said the opposite. He, first of all, felt that the Milky Way was in fact quite large, so an order of magnitude larger, 300,000 light years. And he argued that the spiral nebulae were in fact just tiny clouds of gas within our own galaxy. And they weren't very distant. And our own galaxy was everything that there was. Now, I haven't defined a light year. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this term, and I'm going to come back to the idea of the speed of light a little later, but I just for reference, one light year is given in kilometers down at the bottom. It's extremely large. So these, I shouldn't call the 30,000 light years small. At the end of the debate, this evening debate, there was really no resolution. These were two sides which each had valid evidence supporting their arguments. And the data simply were not good enough yet to resolve this problem. But it didn't take very long. And in 1923, Edwin Hubble came to the rescue, as he has done many times in the history of astrophysics. And I'm sure Matt talked a little bit about his discoveries last week. But in 1923, so he was also working as a observational astronomer. He was studying the stars, as both Curtis and Shapley were. And in 1923, he turned his telescope to M31, to the Andromeda Galaxy. And you can see one of his photographic plates here. That's the core of M31. It's not nearly as nice an image as what I showed you. And I'm showing you this because you can see one of his discovery notes here up in the corner. So these little N's here stand for novae. These are novas. They're exploding stars that have gone off. And people had known about these in M31 before, but they didn't really appreciate their importance. Up here in this corner, you can't see the star at all, but there's a tiny little star here where these markers are. And you can see Hubble's notes. It says VAR! Exclamation mark. This stands for variable star. And what Hubble did was he discovered observationally variable stars, a very particular type of variable star, Cepheid variables, which in fact Professor Bob Rutledge may talk about when he talks about measuring distances. He discovered these variable stars in M31. And these variables are interesting because they pulsate in and out in size, and also in temperature and in brightness. And you can measure that brightness. And the rate at which they pulsate depends on how bright they are. And you can use that fact to measure how far away they are. They're what we call standard candles. And so not only did Hubble show that there are stars in M31, he was also able to measure a distance to M31, a definitive distance using, you know, physics that people understood and had used within our own galaxy. And so he writes in a letter to Shapley, who of course was arguing against Andromeda being a galaxy in its own right, "You will be interested to hear that I have found a Cepheid variable in the Andromeda Nebula." And it is said that Shapley remarked to a friend or a colleague, "Here is the letter that has destroyed my universe." Now, that sounds very depressing, but in fact, it's also said that at that moment, Shapley switched sides, as a true scientist should. He knew he was beaten, and he switched sides and worked on the study of galaxies for the rest of his career. So we now know that this beautiful galaxy, Andromeda, is about 2.5 million light years away. And that is our nearest large neighbor. And I just wanted to take a moment to let you know that you can, in fact, you guys can, in fact, go out and see Andromeda this summer if you like. Some of you may have already. It's not going to look this nice. This is a very long time exposure image. But that's Andromeda up here. And it does come out very nice in binoculars, very nice smudge. And it's usually in the northeast sky, and it's just above the constellation Pegasus. And just to put Andromeda and the Milky Way into context, I just wanted to show you a schematic of sort of the local universe as we now know it, where all of these spiral nebulae that people were studying in the early part of the 20th century exist. There are basically three large galaxies, Andromeda here, the Milky Way — this is not an image of the Milky Way, it's just what we think it looks like — and then another smaller galaxy called the Triangulum. And then all of these tiny little galaxies that you see here are what we call dwarf galaxies and satellite galaxies. And they actually orbit around Andromeda and around the Milky Way, just like the Moon orbits the Earth. So they really are true satellites. And some of them are, in fact, being cannibalized by their parents. So let's flash forward to the future now, or the present, sorry, from 1920. We now know so much more about galaxies. We're not limited to studying these nearby galaxies only in the local group. They don't appear as these tiny little smudges. You know, they appear as this beautiful image of Andromeda that I showed you. And this is all due, of course, to wonderful technological advances, really in telescopes. Bigger dishes, better telescopes, better detectors, all sorts of better techniques. And I just wanted to show you a few images of the types of facilities that myself and my colleagues use. This is probably the most famous observatory site on Earth, Mauna Kea, where I travel a lot. It's on top of a thankfully dormant volcano in Mauna Kea, or in Hawaii, although this volcano behind it is not dormant. And it's the site of many, many telescopes that you can see here. Most of these are, in fact, optical telescopes. There are a few radio telescopes down here. This is the Radio Valley. One I use particularly often is this silver dome here named Gemini, which is a large 8-meter optical telescope. So the optical telescopes have gotten very large and very powerful. On top of that, we can now put telescopes into space and get above the atmosphere and take some absolutely beautifully clear pictures, because the atmosphere is essentially like looking through water. And we can also now observe at multiple wavelengths. So we can take images of the universe in the radio, in X-ray, in the UV, in the millimeter — all these different wavelengths of light that were historically inaccessible to us are now just as important as the optical images that we take. And using these facilities has just, you know, blown open this window on the universe. And it looks completely different now than it did in 1920. And I love to show this image because I think it nicely illustrates how you should think about galaxies, and it also really demonstrates the awe that one should feel when looking at the night sky now. This is an image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope that I just showed you a few years ago. This was, for a long time, the deepest image of the universe, and certainly the deepest image that the Hubble Space Telescope ever took. This is known as the Hubble Deep Field, so many of you may have, in fact, heard of this. And so what astronomers did to take this image was they pointed the Hubble Space Telescope essentially to a random, nondescript part of the sky. So this is just an image of the sky showing you where they pointed. And in fact, if you want to look up in the night sky, it's just above the beginning of the handle of the Big Dipper. And you can see from this image that, you know, it's really nothing special. To give you an idea of how big this image is on the sky, it's 2.5 arc minutes across, which probably doesn't mean that much. But I'm also showing you a picture of the moon to scale with this. So this is the moon. This is how big the moon would be, and this is how big the image is. So this Hubble Deep Field is about 1/12 the size of the diameter of the moon on one side. Okay, and you can picture how big the moon is on the sky, and then just sort of shrink that by 12. So that gives you an idea of how big this picture is. Now let me tell you that everything that you see in this image, all these tiny little wisps and circles and points of light, is a galaxy. There's a couple of stars. I think this is a star here, and there's another one. But almost everything that you see there is a galaxy. And in fact, there's about 3,000 galaxies on that image, in that tiny, tiny, tiny little point on the sky, right? Now imagine tiling the entire sky with Hubble Deep Fields, and how many galaxies you would have in the sky. And, you know, this is not the extent of the entire universe. This was just as deep as we could go when we took this image. And it does go pretty deep. I think the most distant galaxy in this image is about 12 billion light years away. So it is really pushing to the edge of the universe, of the visible universe. But it's also not detecting a lot of fainter objects. So I think if you just, you know, if you take 3,000 in this galaxies in this area, tile the entire sky, you're looking at, you know, 100 billion galaxies or something like that. And each one of those is made up of billions of stars just like our own sun, just to give you an idea of the vastness. And so when you start to, this talk is not about extraterrestrial life, but you can imagine now what you have to do to imagine the possibilities. You have a lot of stars to work with. Now, so let me now talk about really what a galaxy is. So I've been throwing around this term galaxies, assuming that everyone kind of has some vague idea of what I'm talking about, and that's probably right. But I'd like to sort of define a galaxy in a bit more detail now, a bit more scientifically. So you probably know that a galaxy is essentially a collection of stars. So the Milky Way is all the stars in our own galaxy. And these stars are bound together by their own gravity. But galaxies also have other interesting components. So they're also made up of what we call gas and dust. Gas is pretty simple. This is things like hydrogen and helium, carbon, oxygen, some heavier elements. These are the things that stars are made out of. Dust, you may not be so familiar with. Dust is carbon and silicates, carbonates and silicates. Probably a better term for dust would be soot. It's very much like soot. And dust is produced by stars during their lifetime and also through the death of stars. And you can see, in fact, the dust in Andromeda here. These dark regions here are dust lanes. So this soot acts in a galaxy just like it would on a window. It blocks the light coming through from behind it, and it makes the region dark. So there really are stars in these dark areas, but their light has been blocked. Another thing that's in galaxies, of course, is black holes. And in fact, most galaxies that we know of, most massive galaxies, in fact, all the massive galaxies that we've looked at, have supermassive black holes in their center. And by supermassive, I'm talking about, you know, millions to billions of times the mass of our own sun. These have formed at the center. And again, today, luckily, these are largely dormant. And then the other thing that galaxies are made of, in fact, what dominates galaxies, as with most of the universe, is dark matter. So Matt probably talked about dark matter in his last lecture. And of course, you can't see the dark matter in this image by definition. But it's there, and it's in fact holding Andromeda together. And it would live in be distributed in a huge halo around this galaxy, and it would extend far beyond the extent of the visible light. Galaxies have a wide range in characteristics. There are some low-mass galaxies, and by low-mass, I'm talking about sort of 10 to the 7, so 10 billion times the mass of our own sun, all the way up to 10 to the 12 times the mass of our own sun, so 1,000 billion. They also have a variety of sizes. They're, again, small ones, so the low-mass ones tend to be small. Anywhere from 1,000 to 300,000 light years across. So the small end would correspond to those dwarf galaxies, those satellite galaxies that I mentioned that orbit Andromeda, like these guys here. And then the large ones would correspond to galaxies like Andromeda and then some even larger. And I already mentioned the black holes. We find galaxies living alone in the universe, isolated on their own. We find them in pairs. We find them in galaxy clusters where you have hundreds or thousands of galaxies bound together. And we also find them in superstructures, large filaments and nodes in what we call the cosmic web, or the distribution of large-scale structure on the sky or in the universe. And then there are large voids in the universe where there's nothing. This is a beautiful mosaic, really illustrating the variety of galaxy shapes and colors out there. So I'm really lucky when I give these talks because I obviously have so many visuals that I can choose from that are all just absolutely awesome. I'm going to talk about these different kinds of galaxies in a minute, but you can see that you have some very bizarre shapes. You have these long lenticular-like galaxies. These are quite blue. We have these beautiful spiral pinwheels that you see here. Some very loosely bound spirals down here, and then some sort of nondescript red blobs, essentially, and then everything in between, and some which, of course, also really defy any kind of classification. I'm looking for some weird ones here, like that one. This is sort of a zoom-in, taking some particularly nice examples. These are all real images, by the way. This is known as the Hubble sequence, so Hubble's surfaces again. He spent quite a bit of time classifying galaxies, and he organized them into what's called the Hubble sequence. And I'm not going to go into this in detail, but essentially I'm going to be talking about two different kinds of galaxies. We have what are called elliptical galaxies, which you see over here. They have the E designation. And they're called elliptical galaxies because they're large, just elliptical shapes, not very much structure. On this far side, we have what are called spiral galaxies. And so there's this sort of progression from ellipticals to spiral shapes, where you get less and less elliptical, you start to get these spiral arms, and you change your color as well. And then I'm not going to talk about these different, this different set down here, and maybe a little bit later. There's a third classification, which are called irregulars. And so this would be an irregular galaxy that doesn't really fit into either of the two. So I'm going to talk about these galaxy types in a little bit more detail now. So we'll talk about elliptical galaxies first. This is a beautiful example of an elliptical. This is M87. It's 52 million light years away. It's a large, round galaxy. It's very yellow in color, as you can see. It's essentially, and all other elliptical galaxies are essentially shaped like footballs. They are characterized in the following way. They're very, very massive. They are, in general, the most massive galaxies in the universe, although there is such a thing called a dwarf elliptical. We know now that if we study the stellar populations of these galaxies, that they're quite old. The stars in them are very old. And they're not producing new stars. There's no gas and dust in these galaxies. There's no raw material to form new stars within the ellipticals. So what they've got is what they're stuck with, essentially. And what they've got are stars which were formed a long time ago and have basically just been getting old through the lifetime of the universe. Furthermore, not only are these stars old, but they seem to be very uniform. They're all the same types of stars. They're made up of the same kind of materials. So we think that ellipticals formed early on after the Big Bang And that most of the stars within them formed at the same time and have been evolving together as a group ever since with very little change. One of the interesting things about ellipticals is that we preferentially find them in galaxy clusters. So if you remember, I said galaxies could live in isolation or pairs, or they can also be found in clusters, where we have hundreds or thousands of galaxies pulled together by gravity. And this is a beautiful image of the galaxy cluster Abel 1689. And all of those yellow blobs that you see there are elliptical galaxies which are bound together by gravity in this galaxy cluster. So it's an extremely massive object. And again, so it's beautiful to look at, and it has many, many uses. Galaxy clusters are very useful for all sorts of cosmological questions that Matt Dobbs would have been talking about. But again, you can see how useful galaxies are for also just understanding our universe. I don't know if anyone can actually see this through the lights, but okay. Can you see that line right there? There's another one down here, and if you look carefully, you can see them everywhere. It's like there are all these arcs around this galaxy cluster. These weird objects, I'm sure some of you know what they are not within the galaxy cluster. They're background galaxies. You can see that they have different colors. Many of them are quite blue. They're background galaxies to this cluster, much, much more distant than this cluster is. And Einstein's theory of general relativity tells us that mass can affect light, just like it can affect other mass. And that was not a very clear way of saying that if you have matter in the universe, it can bend light. And so when you have an extremely massive cluster like this in the universe, and you have galaxies behind that massive cluster, and there's light traveling from those background galaxies towards us, and they hit that galaxy cluster, that light is going to be bent around the galaxy cluster, and it's warped and focused and magnified just as if there was almost a magnifying glass or a glass of water or something right in front of those galaxies. And so that's what you're seeing here, are these warped images of background galaxies due to the galaxies as well as the dark matter in the clusters, in the cluster. And so this is known as gravitational lensing, and this is one of the key pieces of evidence for dark matter in the universe. So again, these useless island universes that nobody cared about in 1920 have given us one of the key pieces of evidence for what 25% of the universe is made out of. So now we'll talk about spiral galaxies. Spiral galaxies should be very near and dear to our heart because that's in fact what the Milky Way is, and of course what Andromeda is. And this is a beautiful picture of sort of a typical spiral, M101. And you can see why they're called spiral galaxies. They have this beautiful pinwheel structure with spiral arms. And they're quite different than ellipticals. So this one looks very circular, but if you were to turn it on its side, as you can with this one, NGC 891, you see that it's a disk. It's a very flat pancake. You can see the dust lanes here on this galaxy. You can see it a little bit here as well, but you can really see it along the plane of the disk. Spiral galaxies have a lot of gas and dust in them. And there's a lot of raw material for making new stars. So this is one of the main differences between spirals and ellipticals. Spirals, we call them old, dead, and red. And spirals are beautiful, blue, ongoing star formation, active galaxies that are continually replenishing their stars. They're predominantly doing it in these spiral arms here. You can see the color difference. This central region is actually older, and it actually looks a lot more like a small elliptical galaxy. But there's a lot of star formation, new stars being born in these spiral arms. You can also get these really weird, what we call barred spirals, that seem very angular, and they have these long bars in the center. And so they also have a very complex stellar population because they're continually replenishing their stars throughout the history of the universe. So if anyone, I'm going to skip over this in the interest of time, but I can come back and talk a little bit about the origin of this spiral structure. I want to move on to irregular galaxies. So these are galaxies that don't fit in anywhere. They're not ellipticals, they're not spirals. They're often a combination of both. And we now think, so they used to just be a classification of weird stuff in the universe. But we now think that many, at least more massive, irregular galaxies are in fact the result of galaxy-galaxy mergers, as we call them. And so these are sort of, I call them the ultimate cosmic train wreck. These are two galaxies, and you can see an early phase merger up here, NGC 2207, where you have two spiral galaxies which are colliding together. And they will smash together, go through a very complex gravitational dance, and eventually, we think, they will settle down and form what looks an awful lot like an elliptical galaxy, and then just evolve passively into the future again. These are two more violent-looking mergers, probably more advanced in the merger. This is known as the Tinkerbell triplet. There's, I think, three merging galaxies in here. Again, you can see that these are spirals. And this is the Tadpole galaxy. And you can see that you can get these really weird structures we call these tidal tails. And I'm now going to show you a really amazing simulation done by a colleague of mine at the University of Toronto named John Dubinsky, who models galaxy mergers on his computer for a living. And what he's going to show you, or what's going to be shown in this simulation by him, is in fact a very important merger, which is the future merger between M31, the Andromeda Galaxy, and our own Milky Way. So they are, in fact, on a collision course. They're moving towards each other. And we think that they will hit each other in, I think, about 3 billion years. And this is what the collision is going to look like from the outside. So you can see they have sort of a first pass, and they get slowed down by the strength of gravity between them. But they have enough velocity that they're able to sort of pass each other and overshoot. But then they get forced back, and they turn around and will emerge again. And during the merger, you get all this material which is flown out in these tidal tails like we saw in that Tadpole galaxy image. And eventually, the two nuclei will come together, all the material will fall back onto the galaxy, and you can see now that it's starting to look an awful lot like an elliptical, not necessarily in color, but in shape. If there are, as we know there are, two black holes in the center of each of these galaxies, these black holes will also merge. So it can be quite violent. And I know we are very low on time, and I want to talk about galaxy formation, but I can't resist showing you this other view that he has shown, which is actually the merger as seen from the Earth. And so there's our Milky Way. This is a bit slower. It sped up. I think it's something like 500 million years per second. So you can see all of all this graininess that you see is the peculiar motions of the stars within our own galaxy. And you can see the disk of the galaxy, and this is M31. Most of the movement that you see of M31 there is not M31 itself moving, but it's our orbit, our change of viewpoint moving as the sun orbits the center of the Milky Way. But now here comes Andromeda in into the pass. And then something really interesting happens in a second right now. The sun's orbit gets perturbed. And instead of moving around the galaxy on a circular orbit as we're doing, we start moving in a radial plunging orbit. So we're going in and out through the center of the Milky Way in just an orbit that's going like this. And so that's what you're seeing. Now, of course, anyone living on the Earth in 3 billion years would only get a snapshot of this at any particular time. But it's kind of like being on a roller coaster. And you can see the two nuclei now are about to merge. And it's starting to look, again, a lot more like an elliptical galaxy. Now, there are two massive black holes at the center of the galaxy as well. So we just hope that in that radial orbit we don't get too close and get sucked in. Now, speaking of black holes, there is sort of a subgroup of galaxies known as active galaxies. And these can be found in both types of classifications, elliptical, spiral, as well as irregular galaxies. And by these, I just mean galaxies which have a particularly large amount of activity or energy being produced within them. And this can come in two forms. This can be a lot of star formation, lots and lots of stars being born, or it can also come through accreting black holes. And so I'll talk just first about the star formation. So when I'm talking about vigorous star formation, I'm talking about galaxies that are forming stars on the order of maybe 10 to 100 to 1,000 suns per year. To put that into context, the Milky Way right now is forming about 1 to 3 solar masses per year. So these active galaxies are forming stars at rates orders of magnitude more than the Milky Way. They're huge starbursts. This is a very famous one known as M82. It's a spiral galaxy. It has a massive starburst going on in the center. This red light that you see here is actually an outflow, which we think is being driven by the star formation, supernova explosions, which go along with the star formation. When you form stars, you form a lot of very massive stars very quickly, and they almost immediately, like within a million years, explode. So you get these outflows from the poles of the galaxy here, where material is being driven out by this energy. We can also have accreting black holes. So instead of having a dormant black hole in the center of a galaxy, you have a black hole which has a lot of matter around it. And that matter is spiraling inwards and being swallowed by the black hole. And as it spirals inwards, all sorts of interesting physics happens, and that accretion disk can be very luminous. And you can also get these huge energetic jets coming out from the north and the south. Well, not the north and south, but the two poles of the galaxy. And so this is another famous active galaxy known as Sen A down here. It's an elliptical galaxy. You can see the faint starlight with a very strong dust lane that runs across the front of it. So it's not a usual elliptical. And you can see these radio and X-ray jets of material coming out of the poles. And they're many times larger than the galaxy itself. And this is being fueled from the black hole. This is just an artist's conception of what this would look like. And I mention these because these are very rare today, but they are in fact what we think are these types of objects we think are very important phases in forming galaxies. We think that galaxies go through these kinds of phases when they're building their black holes and their stellar masses. And so these kinds of galaxies become, though rare today, much more common and much more important as we go back in time and early after the Big Bang. So that links me to the last part of the talk, which is the origin of galaxies. And so Matt Dobbs may have shown you, in fact, this exact picture. Did he? Yeah, okay. So you know a little bit about the history of the universe then. And Matt was, of course, talking about this region right here. And I study this region right here. So we have the Big Bang, we have inflation, we have, following inflation, something we call the Dark Ages, where not much happens in the universe. So we start with this sort of particle physics plasma. The universe is expanding, and not much happens for about the first 400 million years. And then around 400 million years, stars turn on, we think. This is not hard science at this point. Around 400 million years, we think the first stars begin to burn and turn on. And those stars somehow form together, group together to form the galaxies that we see today. And all of this happens over, essentially 12 or 13 billion years in the history of the universe. And so we have to somehow go from these initial quantum fluctuations, these small overdensities in mass, to somehow produce these beautiful and very complex structures that we see around us, like the Milky Way, Andromeda, M87, and then, of course, planets and people as well. And we are helped in this study of the formation of galaxies, and really the study of the evolution of the universe as a whole, by this absolutely amazing fact. And it blows my mind how lucky we are that this fact is true and that we can use it to do cosmology in astrophysics. Because really, everybody, I think you all know this already, but when you really think about it, what I'm about to tell you is so unique to astrophysics. It really doesn't happen in any other science or anywhere else in life. And Of course, I'm talking about the fact that light travels at a finite speed. And this very fact alone allows us to use telescopes as time machines to literally see back in time. And I'll tell you how we do that. So everyone, I think, here knows that light travels at a constant speed, 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. This is what Einstein told us in his theory of relativity, which means light takes a certain amount of time to get from me to you, from the sun to the earth, and from, you know, those distant galaxies in the Hubble Deep Field to us. And so, for example, I like to use the example of the sun. When we look at the sun, the light that is reaching our eyes, entering our eyes in the sun, I mean, don't look directly at the sun, but when you look at the sun, that light that is reaching your eyes left the sun 8 minutes ago. Because the light, or the sun, is 8 light minutes in distance from us. It's so far away that light takes 8 minutes to get to us. So when we look at the sun, we are in fact seeing back in time 8 minutes. We're seeing the sun as it existed 8 minutes ago. And so if the sun were to explode or collapse into a black hole, we wouldn't know for 8 minutes. A small comfort, I suppose. Yeah. So, doesn't seem that amazing, but now apply this to the Andromeda Galaxy, which is 2.5 million light years away. So the light that's traveling between the Milky Way and Andromeda took 2.5 million light years to make that 2.5 million years to make that journey. So if we turn that around and we say, instead of us looking at Andromeda, think about alien astronomers on a planet orbiting a star in the Andromeda Galaxy looking back on us. And let's say they've got a really, really powerful Hubble Space Telescope. I don't know what their alien would be called, not Hubble, but... And they can zoom in and focus that telescope on the Earth. They would see the Earth as it was 2.5 million years ago. So if they were looking at us right now, they wouldn't see us. They would see Lucy, you know, walking across the plains of Africa, right? So it's an amazing tool if you're an alien anthropologist in Andromeda and you want to study, human evolution on the Earth, because you can literally, if your lifetime was long enough, of course, you could literally watch it happen as that light reached you. And this is exactly what we do with galaxies. And so I hope I've really impressed upon you how amazing it is. So when I go to a telescope, I am gathering photons that have been traveling through space unhindered, not for millions of years generally, but for billions of years, until they get caught by me, which is pretty amazing, and recorded on my computer. And so I'm looking back in time billions of years, and when I see these images of the galaxies, I'm seeing them as they existed billions of years ago, or conversely, a million or a billion of years after the Big Bang. So I'm seeing back in time, and I'm seeing them during the phases of their formation. Now, of course, I don't have a very long lifetime, so I can't just zoom in on a galaxy and watch it evolve. But what I can do is take snapshots of galaxies at different distances. And each of those distances correspond to a different distance in time, a different distance in the past, all the way back to the edge of the visible universe, essentially. And then I can try and link those images together. So it's like, you know, taking a snapshot of a family reunion. And from that snapshot of a family reunion, I'm trying to determine how the life of a human progresses from a baby, a newborn, all the way to old age. And I can't watch a human evolve through their entire life, but I can take the snapshot of an entire family which has all of these different phases, and if I can rank them in chronological order, then I can put a story together. So that's essentially what I try and do. So I'm just going to highlight a few of the key results that we, meaning the entire cosmology community, have found over the last few years that tell us a little bit about how we think galaxies formed and evolved through the lifetime of the universe. And so what I'm talking about is the evolution of galaxies with time. So after galaxies, you know, small galaxies we think have formed, how they evolved through time to the present day. And I just really want to highlight one general trend, which has really become clear sort of over the last 10 years. And that is, as you can imagine, galaxies were more active in the past. We can sort of pinpoint now the times and the time scales over which we think galaxies were doing most of their formation and their and the physics which evolves them. And so this plot that I'm showing you here is essentially showing, you know, what I was just talking about, taking these different snapshots of galaxies at different distances, which means different ages, essentially, or times after the Big Bang. And so on the horizontal axis here, we have the age of the universe. So this is essentially the Big Bang down here, and we're moving forward in time to today. On this vertical axis, we have what we call the star formation rate density. And this is essentially the rate at which galaxies are forming stars, sort of seen globally, averaged over many, many galaxies. That's why we call it a density. So, but it's really just as, on average, how rapidly or how vigorously are galaxies forming stars at any particular time. And so if you go to today, which is down here, you see that the number is quite low. So as I said, the Milky Way is sort of one star per year. Not very exciting. As we go back in time, you see this drastic rise in the rate of star formation. So you go back in time a little bit, and suddenly galaxies are just forming stars all over the place. They're so active, they're building up so much stellar mass, they're turning all of this raw material into the stars that we see today. Of course, we know that this had to happen, right? Because we see all of these massive ellipticals around us. They have very, very old galaxies. And these stars had to be formed at some time. But the interesting thing is that we're starting to, we think, see a peak in this star formation, which is happening somewhere around sort of 2 billion years old, so 2 billion years after the Big Bang. And then it starts to decline again. And this part, the data becomes a little hazy. There are some, you know, things that could go wrong in here. But in general, we see this increase of star formation into the past, and then we start to see a turnover again. And it's really, really a rapid increase. This is two orders of magnitude here. So these are galaxies like M82 that I showed you with that huge outflow. This is just a snapshot of some of the most distant galaxies ever seen in the universe, when the universe was less than a billion years old. We also see, as we go back in time, an increase in what we call the merger rate. So this is just how often galaxies are being smashed together in these cosmic train wrecks. And again, this is sort of an old plot. It's from about 1999. It's a rapidly evolving field, so this is, in fact, an old plot. And again, we're moving forward in time in this direction. So this is back in time, and this is sort of today here. And then this is pushing towards that 2 billion years after the Big Bang. And this is the fraction of galaxies which are undergoing mergers, like you see here. And you see very distinctly that as we go back in time, the rate of mergers also increases. So we think it's something like this, that it's in fact driving that increase in star formation as well. Galaxies are undergoing these huge train wrecks, and it's such a violent process that it triggers and induces all of this star formation during it. And so these galaxies smash together, there's a huge starburst, and then they all kind of settle down to form an elliptical galaxy, we think. And then going along with this story, we can also trace the density, the number density, or how common these other kind of active galaxies are. These active galactic nuclei, as we call them. So these galaxies which have these very active growing black holes in the center, which are accreting material and throwing out these huge jets. So in these galaxies, the central black hole is growing very, very rapidly as well. And we can, again, these galaxies are fairly rare today, but we can trace their number in the past. And this plot, again, this is going back in time now, billions of years. So again, time is moving forward this way. This is today. This is the relative space density of these types of active galaxies. You can see that it rapidly increases and then peaks again somewhere around 2 billion years after the Big Bang. Sorry, I had that backwards, this direction. So it peaks somewhere around 2 billion years. So at the same time as we see this increase in merging and this increase in star formation, we also see this increase in the number of galaxies which have these growing black holes in the center. So these three things seem to go together, smashing galaxies together, forming their stars, and growing their black holes. And this can be understood very well within the context of what we call hierarchical structure formation. So this might have been something, or might not have been something, that Matt Dobbs mentioned last week, because the framework for hierarchical structure formation actually comes from precision cosmology that he was talking about, from measurements of the cosmic microwave background, and the nature of dark matter. So he was probably telling you that we think we live in this lambda cold dark matter universe where the geometry is flat, but it's made up of this bizarre dark energy and dark matter, and then a very small amount of regular matter like you and I are made out of. And that type of universe is expected to form structure in a very particular way. And the way it is expected to form structure is by forming small things first, small clumps of matter first. So we start with the quantum fluctuations after the Big Bang, and then the first thing that those fluctuations grow into are small clumps of overdensities. And I'm talking about, you know, star cluster size or very, very small dwarf galaxies, that type of thing. And then we think, so, and then hierarchical structure formation would then state that these small overdensities and small structures, small groups of stars, would be smashed together in these train wrecks to form larger and larger galaxies, which seems to be exactly what we're seeing when we start from the other end and look at the galaxies from Earth and trace our way backwards towards the Big Bang. So this idea is sort of shown here in the schematic, where you start with very small objects. They start to merge together to form these slightly larger clumps, and then by the present day, you get large galaxies. Now, the details are kind of strange and not well understood, because what we do know, and those of you who have been really paying attention may have noticed this, we do know that the most massive galaxies today are in fact the oldest. And the smaller galaxies tend to be those spirals, and they're the ones who are still actively forming stars. And this is in fact backwards to what hierarchical structure formation would predict. They would predict that the small objects form stars here, and the larger objects are just forming stars today. And we see the opposite. So there are still a lot of open questions in this field. But the basic framework is there. We start with small pieces. We merge them together. And just somehow we need to merge them together more efficiently at early times to produce these really massive old ellipticals and clusters. And so sort of at these phases, or this time in the age of the universe, is where you start to get galaxies like this, like these merging systems, the Tinkerbell triplet, like M82, like these supermassive black holes which are growing. They smash together, they form their stars, they form their black holes, and then they slowly evolve to become ellipticals today. And so I want to finish, well, I'll just introduce this since it comes on so quickly, with another really nice simulation by John Dubinsky. So now instead of two spiral galaxies like the Andromeda and M31 smashing together, we're going to look at the formation of a really supermassive elliptical in a hierarchical sense. And so what you're going to see is hundreds of tiny, small pieces, very small galaxies and star clusters, which are going to smash together and build up over 10 billion years. Something that looks a lot more like an elliptical galaxy in the center of a cluster. So this is very sped up, as you can see. And you can see a lot of similar things happening as with the spiral galaxies. You see all this matter being sort of thrown out of the central mass. You can see, I'll just point them out here before I replay it, because it's quite fast. You can see wisps of matter here. These are these tidal tails. There's, in fact, some matter which is streaming off in this direction here. And it's all forming this central elliptical galaxy in the middle and some smaller elliptical galaxies around it. So we think it's something like this. And while all of this is happening, every time one of those things smashes through this galaxy, you get a starburst, you fuel that black hole, you'll have jets coming out. All you're seeing really here are sort of particles of starlight. You don't see all that extra activity which would be happening on top of it. And in the end, you can see that we sort of end up with something that looks a lot like M87. Which I showed you at the beginning, where we have this central massive elliptical, these tiny little, not tiny, but smaller galaxies surrounding it. So we think we're starting to put together, you know, all these different pieces of evidence are coming together to really sort of support this hierarchical structure formation theory where everything hangs together. It fits within the type of results that Matt Dobbs was talking about as well. But as I say, there's still a lot of open questions in this field. It's, no pun intended, an evolving, very evolving field. So I'll end with that wonderful simulation. Thank you so much for your time.
I'll let people write down questions, but have a wonderful, different, great talk, Tracy.
Thank you very much.
We have a useful gift.
Thank you. Should I open it now?
You can open it now. Okay. Everybody else can.
Oh, okay. He told me it was a beer mug. Yeah.
They know.
But you know what it is. I don't. It looks like a beer mug. It is a beer mug. Thank you very much. Oh, it's a beer mug with my name on it, just what I need. Thank you. It's very nice.
Next week, I should let you know that,
feedback.
Andrew Cumming will be speaking for the Department of Physics. He'll be talking about In Search of New Worlds, the Discovery and Characterization of Exoplanets. The host, I'm not going to be here next week, not because there's been a protest that I would admit to, and the chair of physics, Charles Gale, will be handling the questions and doing the kind of straight man thing that I'm doing, pathetically. And as you have questions ready, my questions are being sorted by Arhan, who's picking out good ones to make me look good before I tell my joke about the three-legged dog. Thank you. Okay, we're ready to go.
Okay.
As I forgot to say this week, just like in McGill's courses and tests, legible handwriting is a plus. We do appreciate it. Do electromagnetic forces play a role in the spiral formation of galaxies?
So you mean, I'm assuming by that you mean the formation of the spiral structure in the galaxies. And this actually... I have a slide to show this. The quick answer is no. We think it's mostly gravitational effects. And it is, in fact, it is a poorly understood problem. Now, we think the formation of spiral structure probably happens through gravitational perturbation. So what I'm going to show you here is another movie, which shows a large galaxy which is being perturbed by a satellite. And that satellite, the gravitational effects that satellite induces, is what seems to be creating this spiral structure. So this is not proof that this is how it happens. This is just showing that you can produce spiral structure through this perturbation. And so you can see this small galaxy being cannibalized, and you see very clearly the spiral structure being produced. And then there's still some of it left over at the end of the simulation. This is not easy to explain verbally because it's something that comes out of the simulations, really, and how the different particles interact with each other. But you can see it again here. Now, the interesting thing is how these spiral arms persist. Once you start these spiral perturbations, they tend to persist in the galaxy. They're sort of it's sort of positive feedback, right? They're self-preserving. And I like to talk about these because a really good analogy is, in fact, a traffic jam here on Earth. And again, it's not electromagnetic forces really here. It's gravitational. And so what you have happening is you set up these spiral structure, these spiral arms, which are now, by definition, sort of enhanced density regions within the galaxy. And when you have enhanced density, you have more mass, and that mass has a stronger gravitational field. And so what you have happening is a star which is rotating around in the galaxy, and it comes in, let's say, from this side where there's not a lot of stars. It's sort of in between the spiral arms. And it gets pulled into the spiral arm, which is large and dense. and it's slowed down and it's attracted to the spiral arm. And everything in there is kind of compressed due to the gravitational field, and so you get induced star formation within these spiral arms, which creates more stars which get caught there. And eventually the stars will move out, but they're kind of always pulled back slightly by that spiral arm. So they sort of speed up as they come in, they get caught, they get slowed down, and then they speed out again. And so it's very much like a traffic jam in the sense that if you imagine there is some, so you can see it over here, let's say there's some disturbance, everyone's moving along Highway 20 very nicely, and there's some disturbance here, this guy has a rabbit run in front of him and he slams on his brakes. So he slows down and the cars behind him slow down as well. So this is sort of mimicking the gravitational force, which is creating these spiral arms. But eventually, this original car that slammed on its brakes would move out of this disturbance, take his foot off the brake and move forward again. But the disturbance persists. And you can see this happening on the highway all the time. Somebody slows down to look at an accident, and 2 hours later, you're still stuck in this traffic jam, and you have no idea why. And it's because you get this self-perpetuating density enhancement. And it's the same thing that's happening in the spiral arms. So people are pretty sure that this is why they persist. They're not so sure about how they start, but they do think it's gravitational versus something like electromagnetic.
Okay, I got a bunch of related questions here. Sort of two really related ones. What role do black holes play in galaxy formation? Black hole first, then galaxy, or what? And this one, a little bit more of a darker theme that I've noticed in these in the talks, which is, what keeps us the central black hole from eating our whole galaxy?
Okay, so this first one, well, they're both very interesting, but this first one about the role that black holes play in the formation, central supermassive black holes play in the formation of galaxies, is really, really interesting, because this is, in fact, one of the key questions that people in my field are asking right now. Because people have noticed, well, they've noticed a few different things, and I've described one piece of evidence, which is this sort of correspondence between the increase in star formation as we go back in time in the universe, and also the increase in these active black holes. We see that they're both getting more common. We see that they happen in the same objects. So we know that they're both important for star formation. But there's this really neat result from the local universe when people study local galaxies. And this is what we often call, well, I mean, you can call it many different things, but you can study local galaxies to try and get a handle on what's happening in the early universe, kind of doing galactic archaeology almost, looking for traces in their properties that can tell you something about how they formed. And one of the things that people have noticed is that every galaxy, every massive galaxy that we look at, has a supermassive black hole in its center. This is universal. Secondly, the mass of that black hole is correlated with the mass of the what we call the stellar spheroid which surrounds it. So in the case of an elliptical galaxy, that's essentially the mass of the elliptical galaxy. In the case of something like the Milky Way, that would be the mass of that central yellower bulge that I said was kind of more like an elliptical galaxy in the central regions of our galaxy. So there's this correlation between the two. So big galaxies form big black holes and form lots and lots of stars. And that might not be that, I mean, it's kind of a duh statement, right? Like, but it really is confirmation that there's something going on between the black hole and the stars. Now, it might not be causal. They might not be affecting each other. But whatever physics is determining how many stars a galaxy forms is also determining how massive the supermassive black hole is. So we know that there are these links, and people are now trying to determine what those links are, and it's really a totally open question. But the kinds of things that people are investigating right now, in particular the theorists, are energy feedback mechanisms from the black hole to the rest of the galaxy. So you have these huge jets which are coming out of the supermassive black hole, and you also have a lot of radiation energy which is coming off of this accretion disk as matter spirals in. So that's a lot of energy which is being injected back into the galaxy, and it's got to affect the galaxy in some way. So part of the question here is black hole first and then galaxy. We think they sort of evolve in tandem, but one way of looking at it might be that you have a large galaxy which is forming. It's collapsed in on itself. It has a lot of raw material. It's forming stars. It's sort of ramping up its star formation. At the same time, it's starting to slowly grow a black hole in the center. So the black hole doesn't start out very massive, but as the stars form around it and it pulls material in, it grows along with the stars. But eventually that black hole gets so massive that the feedback from it can actually disrupt the star formation that's happening in the galaxy. It can blow out all of the raw material that galaxy started with and halt star formation rapidly. So in that picture, you would sort of start with a starburst first, with a baby black hole in the center, slowly growing, which would then reach maturity and feedback and halt the star formation and cut it off. And so this is one of the ways that people think that you can kind of form these elliptical galaxies, where all of the stars are so uniform in age that they start, these elliptical galaxies start forming stars through, say, a merger, but then very rapidly that star formation is cut through the central supermassive black hole, and that stops it, cuts it off, and then the thing just evolves forward in time. That's just a model that people are currently investigating. So coming to the other question about what keeps a central black hole from eating its whole galaxy, this is essentially just an energy budget. So you can kind of think of it as, you know, we can talk about the Hubble Space Telescope, which is currently orbiting the Earth. And it's in a stable orbit. It has enough energy that it's, you know, the way we think of an orbit in physics is that it's falling towards the Earth, but it's moving so quickly that it keeps missing it. So you guys might have seen this. Can I draw on the blackboard?
Is that?
You might have seen this very not-to-scale cartoon of the Earth. And you have a cannon, which is firing a cannonball, right? And if it fires it with, you know, if I just sort of throw a baseball forward with not much energy, the cannonball just kind of falls to the Earth. If I fire it off with some more energy, it falls a bit further and falls to the Earth. If I give it enough energy, it falls and it misses the Earth. And it just keeps falling around the Earth forever. And so this is a nice way of understanding orbits, and this is sort of what we call free fall. And this is what satellites do, of course. And so the idea here is that the cannonball has enough energy, or the Hubble Space Telescope has enough energy, that it's able to stay in a stable orbit. And the same thing is happening in something like a galaxy. Our sun, for example, is moving fast enough around the center of the galaxy that it has enough energy to keep itself stable and up and to escape the black hole, which it's continually falling towards, but always missing. But there is a sweet spot where if you get too close, you fall in, right? And that's why these black holes grow.
Okay, here's a question my wife asked a trained theoretical physicist a week or two ago, and she wasn't happy with the answer that I gave her, so I will now pose a question to you, Tracy.
Science can't answer this question.
I answered it very well, I thought, actually, but I'm a good critic. I don't think it's Carolyn's question, actually, but somebody else had the same question. I understand that the redshift measures how fast a galaxy is moving away from us, but how do you convert that velocity into a distance?
Okay, so I actually have another slide for this. So the short answer is that alone you can't. So I'm going to back up since not. Did Matt go through redshift? Does he know? Okay. I will quickly attempt to go through redshift. Redshift is very simple. It can be simple, it can be complicated, depends on how you look at it. A redshift in astrophysics is just a Doppler shift. And a Doppler shift is just the effect that causes an ambulance to change its pitch as it goes past you, or a race car to go, you know, so it goes, that's a Doppler shift. And so as it's coming towards you, it has a higher frequency, and as it's going away from you, it has a lower frequency. So it has that very distinct sound. The same thing happens with light waves. So if an object emits light and it's moving towards you, that light will be shifted towards shorter wavelengths or higher frequencies. This is towards, in the visible, this is towards blue light. So that would be called a blue shift. Most things in the universe are moving away from us, hence the term redshift. And so if something is emitting light and it's moving away from us, that light is shifted to longer wavelengths or lower frequencies or towards the red. Now, it doesn't just have to be red, right? This is just in reference to visible light. Radio light can experience a redshift. All different wavelengths can, and everything is just shifted towards longer wavelengths or lower frequencies. And so if you can measure that shift, you know how fast a galaxy is moving. And so I don't think I really need to go through this slide here because it's quite complicated. But essentially, we can measure that shift by looking for absorption and emission lines in the atomic spectra of the galaxy. Another way, and I'll just mention this quickly, this is a Doppler shift due to velocity. Another way of thinking about this in a cosmological sense has to do with the expansion of the universe, and it's the way we usually think about it or view it in cosmology. And that is, instead of thinking of the galaxy moving away from you and the light being shifted through a Doppler shift, you can think of, unlike matter, you can think of light as being nailed down to the fabric of space-time. And after the light is emitted by the galaxy, it's stuck to the universe. And in the time it takes the light to travel from the galaxy it was emitted from and to reach us, the universe has stretched. It's expanded. And it pulls the light along with it. And so that's what this balloon illustration is supposed to be illustrating. So you can take a blue photon, which has a low wavelength, a high frequency, and as it travels, it gets stretched. And the longer it travels, the larger distance it travels, the longer it travels, the more the universe has expanded, and the more it's stretched. So the redder it is. So that's redshift. That's what the question is about. The question is, how does that give you a distance? It doesn't on its own give you a distance. You need to pinpoint, you need to calibrate redshift to distance somehow. And so this is something known as the distance scale. And Bob Rutledge will be talking about this. This is his entire lecture. So I won't give away too much. But essentially what we have to do is we have to use other methods of measuring distance in the local universe. This can be anything from simple triangulation, like we use here on Earth. We can do that with stars nearby. This can be using, for example, the Cepheids that I mentioned briefly that gave us the distance to M31. We have to go even further, of course, if we want to start reaching things that are distant enough that we can see this effect. Because you obviously, you know, we don't see these kinds of shifts in the wavelength of light until we get to very large distances. So you have to calibrate it using the local universe first. You measure distances to objects, then you measure their redshift, and that tells you a correlation between redshift and distance. You also need to know what your cosmology is. You need to know how the universe is expanding as a function of time, which is what Matt would have talked about a little bit. So all of these come into play. I'll just quickly go to this plot. You see that this axis here is 1 plus z. Z is our symbol for redshift. We don't usually deal in true distances or true times. We usually work with redshift because that's what we know. And turning that into a distance or turning that into an absolute age requires some assumptions that are based on this calibration scale. So usually we, you know, people like me don't make that final leap. We just trace things back as a function of redshift.
There are a couple of questions about dark matter and questions about why is it or is it distributed evenly across galaxies or is it in clumps? And what is it and why is it dark?
So we're now venturing outside of my comfort zone. So there were a lot of parts to that question. So I'll first start with why is it dark? It's dark because we can't see it. So that's why we call it dark matter. We can't see it because it doesn't seem to interact with light. So everything that we see in the universe, we see because it reflects light or it absorbs and re-emits light. You know, we detect things through detecting photons with our eyes or our CCD cameras. And we think that dark matter is a, you know, exotic kind of particle that does not interact with photons. It does not interact with light. Light just plows through it like it's not even there. What it does do is it has mass, so it interacts gravitationally. So we can see its gravitational effects, so that's why we know it's there. So, for example, if I go back to the cluster image, we can measure how much mass must be in this cluster by looking at how those background galaxies are bent. The more they're bent, the more mass must be there. And this is pretty simple to do. I don't do it. It's not that simple to me, but people who do it say it's simple. In the sense that there are not that many assumptions that have to go into it. It's just basic gravity. Then you can add up the light that you see in those elliptical galaxies, and they are way off. There are not enough galaxies in this cluster to be bending that light. You can also measure the random velocities or the orbital velocities of the galaxies in this cluster, because these galaxies are all orbiting around some center region of the cluster. They're all flying around just like the sun flies around the center of the galaxy. And if all there were in this cluster were those galaxies, they're all moving so fast that the whole thing would just fly apart immediately. So that's another reason why we know there has to be a lot more mass there. But you can't see it. And people have done a number of different tests to really, you know, robustly show that it's not visible. And it's not visible simply because it does not interact with photons. Now, the second question was about its distribution. It is pretty uniformly distributed in galaxies. It has this, so one of the side effects to not interacting with light is that you can't radiate. And if you can't radiate, it means, so I have to step back for a second and talk a little bit about how stars and galaxies form. What we think happens is you get this very massive clump of matter, which is being pulled in by its own self-gravity. But it has some amount of inherent energy, like the kinetic energy of its particles. And that energy can hold itself up against the collapse, right? It's not unlike this. It's got enough energy that it can fight against that gravitational force, which is pulling it in. And so if you want to take an object and collapse it down to form a star, you have to get rid of some of that energy. And the way that matter does that is by radiating it away. And I can talk more, if anyone's interested in it, about how that happens. But essentially, the matter converts this kinetic energy to photons and radiates it away. And then it loses that supporting energy and is able to collapse down and form stars and galaxies. So dark matter does not have that property. It can't get rid of its energy. So it stays poofed up. And so that's why when I showed you that picture of Andromeda, you had that stellar disk, which was collapsed down into a very thin disk, and you had that central bulge, which was very compact and bright. And then I said around that is this huge dark matter, what we call dark matter halo. And this is the original dark matter collapsed object, which was never able to follow the light matter, the regular matter, in to this disk in this central region because it couldn't radiate away its energy. So it stays poofed up and fairly uniform. That said, in something like this, there's probably substructure in the dark matter. You probably have, you know, clumps of dark matter in the outskirts, and people do study how this dark matter either theoretically should be distributed, and they also try and map it out with gravitational lensing. Did I answer all the questions? Okay. I thought there was...
No, there's only time for one last question, which is mine. I noticed at the beginning of your talk, and you sort of alluded to it just a second ago, that you said galaxies, they come, you got your little galaxies and you got your big galaxies, and they didn't get bigger than like the really, whatever it was, a trillion mass of the sun. And I wonder if there's any hard limits like for neutron stars and for white dwarfs, like it can't get bigger than some size.
So that is a good question, and I saw a talk on this 2 years ago, and I can't remember the punchline of the talk. So there is a guy who studies this at Queen's named Stéphane Courtois. And so the short answer is there does appear to be an upper limit. And it's interesting in that, so for example, what Stéphane Courtois studies is what we call scaling laws of galaxies. And there are all kinds of relationships which seem to be universal with galaxies in terms of how their rotation speed correlates with the size of the bulge and all these different sort of, you take a large galaxy, you scale it down to a small galaxy, it's got to look the same. And it's through these scaling laws that we think that there is some upper limit to how luminous a galaxy or how massive a galaxy could be, and I honestly just can't remember the answer off the top of my head. But maybe we could put this on the website and I could try and answer it better. I think it has to do with, again, feedback and energy considerations, and at some point you just become too big. Too big.
Well, please fill out all your evaluation forms, and let's thank Tracy again for a great talk.